Daniel was filled with rage. "What?" he snapped at his wife. Sabrina took a step back, alarmed by his tone.
"Nothing, Daniel. I just..."
Pastor Charlie, sensing that the moment was about to spin out of control, leaned back on the sofa and said, "Sabrina has told me about the... other things that the two of you have been experiencing." Again, Daniel's accusatory scowl flashed to his wife. She dodged his stare, lowering her head and fumbling with an errant thread dangling from her blouse. "Daniel," Pastor Charlie continued, "whatever's going on, you can talk to me. You know that."
"Nothing's going on," Daniel insisted.
He did not care if the words rang true.
"So you haven't heard noises?" the minister asked. "You haven't seen anything strange in the past few months? You haven't felt as if something is in the house with you?"
"No, nothing. We've been completely alone."
"Is that how you feel? Alone?" No response. "Have you prayed?"
"Why would I?" Daniel asked coldly.
The concern on Pastor Charlie's face was clear. He was not used to hearing such bleak thoughts from this once happy-go-lucky man.
"Because you're in pain," Pastor Charlie suggested. "Because you've experienced a great loss."
"And what is God going to do about that?" Daniel asked. His palms were beginning to sweat. He wiped them on his pant legs as he inched forward in his seat.
"Is he going to give her back? Is he going to take my daughter and uncrush her skull? Unbreak her bones? Take her beautiful face and patch it back together like a goddamn quilt?"
Sabrina made a small, pitiful whimpering noise, and the sound of it infuriated Daniel. His pale, doughy face was flushed with the flow of hot blood. He turned to his wife.
"Oh, and what? I'm supposed to mourn like you? I'm supposed to shove my sadness down into some deep, dark hole and pretend like nothing has happened?"
"I'm not pretending like nothing happened!" Sabrina screamed.
Daniel ignored her. He turned to the stunned face of Pastor Charlie.
"Well, I can't hide how I feel. Not anymore. I'm mad. I'm furious. I want things, Pastor. I want the respect that other authors get. I want a bestseller. I want a goddamn hardcover. I covet these things. That's a sin, right?"
Pastor Charlie nodded dumbly.
"I want another child. I want a wife who can give me another child."
Sabrina shrieked.
"Oh God, Daniel, stop!"
But Daniel did not stop.
"But most of all, the one thing I want is my daughter back. Why won't God give me my daughter back?"
Pastor Charlie took a breath and attempted to remain calm.
"God didn't take Claire to hurt you, Daniel. God is merciful. He shares the pain you and Sabrina are feeling."
"Bullshit!" Daniel roared. "How could God know?"
"Because he, too, lost a child," Pastor Charlie explained. "He sacrificed his only son so that we may be saved."
Daniel nodded, a bit too enthusiastically, his head bobbing as if it were on a spring.
"That's right! That's right! He sacrificed his son! He made the call! He gave the okay on that one!"
Daniel jammed a finger into his own chest.
"But I didn't. I didn't have a say in my daughter's death. I didn't give the old green light for a car to hop the median and broadside her. He did. God did. So fuck him."
"Daniel."
Sabrina's mouth hung open, not even a breath to fill it. Daniel spun on her, eyes wild.
"What?"
Fat tears spilled from Sabrina's eyes. They coursed down her cheeks like rainwater, carrying with them streaks of black mascara. She took a step away from him, holding one trembling hand out in front of her as if she expected him to lunge her way. Her left heel settled on the plush cream carpet, and Sabrina slowly spun on it, allowing the momentum of the movement to point her toward the hall. A moment later, she was hurrying up the stairs to the second floor, the sobs suddenly too powerful to contain. Pastor Charlie remained on the couch, stunned by the uncharacteristically hateful show Daniel had just put on. There was nothing more to say. A sudden odor filled the room. The scent of decay, of rotten things in darkness. The scent of the well. Daniel winced and looked to Pastor Charles. The long-faced man was fixated on his clasped hands, lost in a silent prayer. He did not appear to notice the foul smell. The odor brought another moment rushing back to Daniel. Standing at his daughter's open grave, watching as the coffin was lowered down into the ground, he had noticed the scent then too, although his grief had kept him from fully recognizing it. Now he remembered, standing at the edge of that hole, an inexplicable gust of air rising up and with it that awful smell of decay. He remembered seeing shadows in the hole. Now, in the theater of his mind, he saw them again, yet this time they moved, swaying like sea anemones. They were arms waving, hands reaching to welcome his daughter into the darkness. "She's in hell," Daniel whispered. From somewhere in the house above, he heard a faint squeak, like the turning of a wheel. A tear slipped free and ran down Daniel's cheek. "I have to go," he said. Pastor Charles stood into a shaft of light, his face lit from above, creating huge pools of shadow that obscured his eyes.
"Please, we need to talk about this," the pastor said, reaching out a hand.
Daniel gave a helpless whimper and raced up the stairs. Sam ended the call. He had left 9 messages for Daniel, and now, on the 10th attempt, an artificial voice told him that the mailbox was full. "Maybe he doesn't have his phone on him," he speculated. "Or maybe he's just not answering," Moore replied. She was standing at the large picture window in her living room, her back to Sam. The knobby green hills beyond were bright with the perfectly even California sunshine. She was a sleek, powerful silhouette against them. "He could be out of town, on a trip." "Out of cell phone range," Sam offered. Moore shook her head. "How many times have you gone out of town since we left Kill Creek? Better yet, how many times have you left the house?" Sam gave a knowing nod. "This is the first." "Exactly. No, Slaughter's there. He's just not answering his goddamn phone." Sam had spent the night at Moore's house, crashing in the sparsely furnished guest room. With one duffel bag packed with only 2 changes of clothes and essential toiletries, he was unprepared for extended travel. He was beginning to realize how spur-of-the-moment this trip had been. He'd never asked himself what would happen if he stayed longer than a day. He had showered in the extravagant bathroom downstairs, letting the water fall like rain over his body. He emerged from the shower, a towel wrapped around his waist, to find Moore at a large vanity. She was running a pair of electric clippers over the sides of her head. Clumps of short black hair fell into the sink below. When she was done, Sam held out his hand. Without a word, she handed him the clippers. He adjusted the guard and began to mow strips through his overgrown hair. Then he removed the guard entirely and shaved off the beard that crept across the lower half of his face and down his neck. In a matter of minutes, he was done. He ran a hand over his buzzed hair, enjoying the sensation against his palm. The night before had passed without incident. No strange noises, no scratching from the ceiling above. Once he thought he heard more stir, footsteps in the hall, but they quickly receded and were gone. Sam was back on the phone in an effort to rouse Daniel, but he knew that if they wanted to check in with him, they would need a new plan of attack. Sam plopped down on a sleek leather couch, picking up a small ivory statue from the coffee table to inspect the outrageously large phallus protruding from it. Classic Moore decor.
So, he said, what now?
We go to him, was her answer.
Go to Chicago?
Why not?
You came here to see me, to see if I was going through the same thing as you.
I came here to make sure I wasn't crazy.
And I'm still not convinced we're not, Moore offered, turning away from the window to face him. Maybe we're both crazy, and Daniel Slaughter is just really bad about checking his voicemail.
There's only one way to find out.
Go to him, Sam sighed. Somewhere in the sky overhead, thousands of miles above them, a jet screamed by.
22. Friday, April 21st. The first rays of dawn began to filter through the lopsided Venetian blinds, but Kate had not slept a wink all night. She stared into the fuzzy orange light with bloodshot eyes, the shadows from the blinds cutting across her face like black prison bars. Normally, that is, back when her life was her own, she would have been furious at not getting any rest. She would have dreaded the sound of her alarm clock buzzing, of dragging herself from bed, of trudging to the shower with invisible weights pulling her down. That scenario now sounded like an absolute pleasure, a welcome respite from her current situation. Exhaustion did not even begin to describe it. Her days and nights had begun to blur with only these moments, staring into the growing sunlight to remind her of the difference between the two. For the first few weeks after the madness began, friends and concerned neighbors would stop by unannounced, knocking on her door and calling out, "Kate? You in there? You okay?" She told them she had the flu, and after that excuse wore thin, she simply ordered them away. Wainwright had been the most persistent, showing up around 7 p.m. every night after work. But she managed to discourage even him. And soon they all stopped coming, leaving Kate to the absolute silence of her tomb-like studio apartment. She lay in her bed, a mattress really, the blankets crumpled in a pile on the floor, her head cocked to the side on her rumpled pillow, her face slack. A few blocks away, church bells chimed. They went through their automated tune with the precision of a Swiss watch, making an artificially joyous sound. There was the distant feeling that she was late, that she should hop out of bed and scramble to get dressed, but this sensation quickly dissipated. She had nowhere to go. No job, no friends, no life. Only this. Only the claustrophobic isolation of the world behind her locked door. From somewhere outside, drifting in like echoes from an alternate universe, came the sounds of waking life. A car honked. A dog barked. A man yelled curse words at no one in particular. Kate recognized these individual noises for what they were, but they no longer held the resonance they once did. They were sounds from the past, heard through a tear in time. In 20 minutes, the sunlight had crept from the uppermost corner of the room to halfway down the wall, illuminating a spread of overlapping photographs as it traveled its daily journey. Each photo was a 5x7 print, some color, some black and white, most from Kate's Hewlett-Packard PhotoSmart printer. It was a mosaic of random frames from various video shoots. A few were of celebrities, a mixture of staged scenes and candid shots. Others were personal pics, various street scenes. Life as she once knew it. These were the most recent additions, photos she had taken as a dark experiment to make sure that what was happening really was happening. Now she knew it was. There was no doubt. In the beginning, she thought it was a fluke, a camera trick, a malfunction within the machine. The first anomalies were present in her footage from the Kill Creek shoot. Most people wouldn't have noticed them as they flashed by at 1/30th of a second, but Kate did. She tracked them down, frame by frame. A shadow that seemed to go against the falling light. A wisp of white in the corner of a dark room. Then they began to take shape. A body. a head, a face staring out from the shadows. Her first thought was that the entire shoot was marred by distracting flash frames. But as soon as she showed the video to Wainwright, the aberrations, a blob of light, a faintly human form, disappeared completely. When a colleague played back the footage that now resided eternally on Rightwire and YouTube, she was stunned to see that the images were flawless. Her mind tried to replay that moment in the second floor hallway when she thought she saw something on her LCD screen. For one split second, the wall was gone, she remembered, and there was an old woman. Not Rebecca Finch in her wheelchair. This woman was standing. Black hair billowed around her head. She was clawing the air as if scraping desperately at the other side of the invisible wall. But Kate refused to let the image take root in her brain. The shadows and wisps of white in her footage were flukes, she assumed. Her files were corrupted. What the world had seen that night contained none of the deficiencies she now obsessed over. Her next shoot was for an up-and-coming indie band, the next big thing, straight out of Iowa. Four mopey white guys in dirty jeans and vintage rock tees. It was late when she returned to the Rightwire offices. The sun was setting, cutting strips of gold through the towering black forms of Lower Manhattan. Kate plugged a USB cable into the base of her camera, connecting the other end to the port on the side of her laptop. The footage downloaded in a flash. She scrolled through it, pausing when something odd caught her eye. It was there again. From take to take, she could follow its transformation like a digital flipbook. A fuzzy, pale cloud in the first minute of footage. A vertical oval by the middle of the session. By the final frame, the object had taken human form, like a ghostly fifth member of the band. Its hollow black eyes stared out at her, its jaw drooped slightly, as if about to scream. Its dark hair suspended in air by a phantom wind. While the rest of the group did their best to look aloof, staring off into space to suggest deep thoughts, this horrible wraith looked directly at the camera. Its curled fingers dug at the open air. It wanted out. It wanted through. To her. She had to tell Wainwright. She could trust him. She needed him to assure her that she was not imagining it, that she was not crazy. Kate's foot tapped nervously as Wainwright flipped through the printed screenshots. She watched his face, but his expression gave no hint to his thoughts. And then he simply shrugged, holding the stack of photos out to her.
"I don't see anything, baby," he said. "I'm sorry."
She stared at the pictures in his hand. She did not want to take them back. She was afraid of what she might find. That night, behind her locked apartment door, the thing returned. Not just to the band footage, but to the Kill Creek shots as well. Kate raced to her computer, frantically clicking on the file that contained the bulk of her video. Her entire library blinked open on the screen, a mammoth window showcasing thousands of thumbnails. She scrolled through them, her fingers leaving wet streaks of sweat on the mouse. It was there, floating next to her famous subjects, hovering above a subway stop, lurking in the background of her family's Thanksgiving dinner. A pale woman with hollow eyes standing just behind her happy, oblivious family. One after another, Kate printed the pictures. She mounted them on the wall in haphazard rows using anything she had, pushpins, tape, glue, rubber cement, chewing gum, nails, screws. She finished late the next morning, the harsh sun of early summer already baking the city outside. On the wall before her was a mosaic of random images, a crudely assembled overview of her collection. For a moment, Kate had simply stared at them, not breathing, mouth open. And then she crumpled into the corner, her body trembling uncontrollably as she shook her head back and forth. "No, no, no." Together, the ghostly images in each photograph formed one monstrous face, spanning from wall to wall, from ceiling to floor. Its pale form flickered in and out like a dying bulb. But it was there, towering over her, staring into her soul with empty sockets. That woman with the flowing jet-black hair. Nearly 2 months later, Kate was curled up on her sweat-stained mattress, knees pressed tightly to her chest, the rising sun painting her apartment with the colors of dawn. Her eyes tracked the room, hopping from photograph to photograph. For the moment, it seemed, the invading spirit had been exorcised from the images, but she knew this was only a trick. It would return. It always did. She gave a tiny, frightening giggle, the sound of sanity escaping like air from a punctured balloon. Her gaze fell upon a wooden handle on the kitchen counter. Oh, yes. Now she remembered what she had been up to the night before. It had seemed like such a cold, cruel thing in the darkness. But now she welcomed the idea. She pulled herself across the mattress, over the edge, and onto the floor. The polished wood was cold against her bare knees. Her skin squeaked as she scooted her body toward the kitchen. In the hallway outside of her apartment came a squeaking sound, like a wheel in need of oil. It moved slowly down the hall, toward her door. Kate did her best to ignore it. She had heard it before, late at night, before she drifted off to troubled sleep. It usually stayed at a distance, a faint sound she could not be sure was even there. Now it was coming closer. She stared at the far wall, wishing she could see through it. She tracked the progress of the sound as it inched its way down the hall. Just outside her door, it stopped. Her fingers touched the base of the kitchen cabinets. She slid them up to the counter, grasping blindly. She found a wooden handle of a knife. She clutched the object to her chest. She was surprised to find that she was not at all frightened. Just the opposite, in fact. She had not felt this confident in months. Outside her door there was silence. And then the doorknob began to turn. Slowly. Testing. It was locked. The knife's blade was cold against her skin.
Hello?
A voice called out. It was a woman's voice, thin and brittle, like ancient paper.
I know you're in there, she said. It's not really a woman,
Kate's mind screamed.
It wants you to think it is, but it's not.
Kate knew the voice of the thing behind the door was that of a deeper sound being forced up into the higher register of an elderly woman.
Why don't you open the door, dear?
With one hand gripped tightly around the wooden handle, Kate pressed the tip of the knife against her wrist. The doorknob began to twist violently as the thing behind the door tried to force its way in. Once again it stopped. Once again there was silence.
We just want to talk to you, Katie,
the voice said. Kate shivered at hearing the thing say her name.
I won't let you in,
Kate growled through clenched teeth. The thing behind the door gave a raspy chuckle.
Oh, sweetheart, you already have.
A new sound got Kate's attention. It was coming from the collage of photos covering her wall. Hadn't she torn those down? She was almost certain she had. She remembered ripping them from the wall in a panic, desperate to be rid of that staring, hollow-eyed face. Yet there they were. And something was behind the photos, scratching against the back of the wall as if trying to dig through it. A finger broke through one photo. The pale digit poked into the light and squirmed like an unearthed grub. Kate held the knife ready. The tip bit slightly into her skin. She sucked in a breath, her entire body shaking.
That's my sister,
the old woman behind the door said.
She wants to make sure you help us.
I'll never help you,
Kate sobbed.
You will,
the voice assured her. Another finger tore through. Photos began to fall, fluttering to the floor as first an arm, then the edge of a shoulder pushed its way into the room.
Katie Ann. That is your name, isn't it? Katie Ann?
The woman thing behind the door asked. It began to repeat her name in an awful sing-song voice.
Katie Ann, Katie Ann, Katie Ann.
Kate closed her eyes. The wall of photos dropped away as a pale form burst through. It tumbled through shafts of morning sunlight and crashed to the floor, stopping in a heap only a few feet from where Kate sat crouched, the knife to her wrist. The pale form twisted its head, and jet-black hair fell away, revealing a rotting face stretched over bone. It stared at her with hollow eye sockets. And Katie put her weight into the knife, driving it downward so quickly that the tip broke through to the underside of her arm. Her mouth opened, and a shocked gasp escaped. She hated the sound of it, fear and regret and weakness. And yet there was no other choice.
Katie Ann,
the sing-song voice called from behind the front door. Kate was not even aware as she dragged the blade up her arm, all the way to the elbow, forcing it past the indention of that groove and into the thick muscle of her bicep. She felt nothing as she twisted the knife around and dragged it back down her arm. A strip of flesh fell free, dangling like the meat of filleted game. Darkness began to creep into the edges of her vision, overtaking once pretty eyes that now bulged wildly from her face. Something warm was rushing down her wrist and into her lap. It began to spurt. Specks of warmth hit the base of her neck. Her eyes stared straight ahead, into the hollow eyes of a Finch sister.
I beat you,
she thought as her mind clouded over. The pale thing smiled curiously at her, as if to say she were mistaken. 23. Saturday, April 22nd.
We came all this way for nothing, Moore thought.
She looked up at the suburban house as the cab pulled to the curb. It was a quaint two-story colonial, white with black shutters, on an elegant, meandering street in Chicago's North Shore. The glow of meticulously landscaped, upscale homes warmed several streets to the east. Beyond these cul-de-sacs and winding lanes, the world was swallowed by the black abyss of Lake Michigan. To their south, the blinking lights of downtown skyscrapers bit into low-lying clouds.
People actually live like this? She asked.
Some people don't care about a view, Sam said. The back door of the cab swung open and Moore got out. Sam followed. They moved hesitantly up the walk to the front porch. Moore reached out to push the doorbell, then paused, her finger hovering in midair.
What do we say? She asked.
Sam didn't respond. Moore pressed the button. From inside, they heard a series of pleasant chimes. No one came to the door. Moore raised a fist and pounded loudly on the door.
Slaughter! Open up!
Silence.
Come on, she thought. Be home. We have to know what's happening. We have to be sure.
Without warning, a shiver ran through her body. She suddenly hoped no one answered the door. She wanted to leave.
If you leave now, you'll never have to know the truth.
There was the sound of a hand on the knob, and the door swung open. A plain, sad-eyed woman stood before them.
Daniel's wife, Moore realized. What is her name? Sabrina. This is Sabrina.
She was probably in her late 30s, although life had recently added countless years to her. A random thought flitted into Moore's mind.
Grief eats your youth.
Yes? May I help you?
Sabrina was forcing a pleasant tone, trying desperately to hold on to a shred of the decorum she once knew. Sam did his best to offer a smile.
Is Daniel home?
And you are?
Sam McGarver. This is T.C. Moore.
Sabrina's expression darkened.
I know who you are, she said. We need to talk to Daniel. It's important. She stood motionless for a moment, looking from Sam to Moore and back. Finally, she took a step back, clearing the way for them to enter. Come in. Sam took a step forward, but Moore pushed past him, entering first. They stood side by side on the beige tile floor of the foyer as Sabrina closed the door behind them. Is he here? Sam asked. Oh, yes, he's here. Sabrina looked up at the ceiling. He's up there. He's always up there. Moore shot Sam a look. She knew where there was. Daniel's office. He was holed up behind his computer, just as they had been for half a year. Well, can we talk to him? Moore was losing patience. She hadn't traveled all this way to be stopped by a skittish housewife. From above, there came the sound of several footsteps as someone moved across the length of a room. Then, once again, silence filled the house. He's not the same, you know, Sabrina said. It was not so much a statement for them, but for the universe at large, and whatever being may be turning its gears. Right. Just right. It had been there before. It had flowed from his fingertips like electricity, and now it was gone. Cut off, extinguished like a candle whose wick has burned too low. You can get it back. You have to. You have to keep writing. Daniel rubbed his sweaty palms on the legs of his jeans and placed his fingers on the keyboard. He stared at the last sentence he had been able to write. The first brick broke free. He tapped a key with his right index finger. His nails were too long. He usually cut them when they got long. He hated the feeling of long nails against the key of a computer keyboard. The cursor blinked at the end of that sentence, begging him to move it forward. The first brick broke free. Behind him, a dark shape moved into the edge of his vision. He became aware of raspy breathing. Daniel didn't know what frightened him more. The thought of it being gone as it was every time he spun around to look, or the thought of it remaining, of it standing there before him. It wheezed as it drew breaths into wet lungs. An image suddenly filled his mind. A creature born prematurely, sitting on trembling, stalk-like legs, a slick sheen of afterbirth glistening on its gelatinous skin, its paper-thin lungs threatening to tear with each raspy breath. It has no eyes. It has no eyes, and yet it sees. Beneath his motionless fingers, the keys began to click all on their own. Letters tumbled across the computer screen. We have her. An invisible hand reached up into Daniel's chest and gripped his heart, ripping it free and pulling it down, down into hell below. He should have known all along what the thing at the edge of his vision looked like. A twisted shape, blonde hair matted to its crushed skull with thick black blood. He jerked his hand away from the keyboard, yet the words continued to race across the screen over and over and over. We have her, we have her, we have her, we have her, we have her. Stop it, he whispered. We have her, we have her. Please, stop. We have her. Without warning, he grabbed the keyboard and yanked it hard, pulling the cord free from the back of the monitor. He flung it across the room. It smashed into the wall and plastic keys rained down on the floor like hail. Still the words streaked across the computer screen faster and faster. We have her, 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 we have her. We have her, 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 have her. The eyeless thing was right behind him. He could see it without even turning. It was standing directly over his right shoulder. Not a thing. It's not a thing. It's your daughter, goddammit. Cold, lifeless fingers grazed Daniel's neck. And he screamed. Sam and Moore heard the muffled shriek from above. They were halfway up the staircase when Daniel came rushing down. He slowed at the sight of them, his fear momentarily overtaken by confusion. Sam? Moore? What are you...
God, he looks so thin, Sam thought. He's wasting away.
He wasn't thin exactly, but compared to the massive man he had been last year, this may as well have been a living skeleton.
What happened? Sam asked. What did you see up there?
Daniel shook his head, unable to put it into words, and he pushed past them. Sabrina was waiting at the bottom of the stairs.
You've brought this into our house!
She yelled as Daniel pushed past her, too. There was such anger in her voice. Months of obedience cast aside as she unleashed her fury.
You did this to us! I told you not to go! I told you not to go!
Daniel threw open the front door and the humid Chicago air grabbed him in its fist. They met in the middle of the front yard. Daniel was sucking in great, desperate breaths.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry about all that. He shook his lowered head like he was apologizing for an unruly dog or misbehaving children.
What happened, Daniel? Sam asked.
Daniel's clothes were too baggy. He was still much larger than Sam, but he had lost an alarming amount of weight in the past year.
There was...
Daniel began, and then he fell silent. They waited. After a moment, he continued.
Upstairs, in my office, there was a girl.
An image appeared in Sam's mind. The burned woman. The thing that crept through the empty halls of his house. The last shred of hope that he might be losing his mind was ripped from Sam. This was not the result of childhood guilt. This was not mental illness or a delusion.
It's visiting Daniel, too. But as something different. Something just for him.
Sam pushed closer, up the front steps.
What did the girl look like?
I don't know.
Daniel, what did she look like?
He paused. Across the street, a middle-aged couple exited their house and paused on their way to the SUV parked in their driveway. They stared over at Daniel's house in confusion.
Mind your own fucking business!
Moore yelled. They could clearly see the couple flinch, and then they hurried to their car, backed out of their driveway, and drove away at top speed. Sam put a hand on Daniel's shoulder.
What did the girl look like, Daniel?
He exhaled a trembling breath.
She was a teenager. She looked just like our Claire, except...
Except what?
Daniel swallowed hard.
Except she didn't have eyes.
She didn't have...
Daniel crumpled to the thick green grass, tears running hot streaks down his face.
What is this?
He asked them.
What's happening?
I don't know, but it's happening to us, too, Moore said. There was no malice in her voice. In fact, there was something very close to compassion. Daniel stared up at them. He looked tired, beaten down, cut off from the zen-like peace he had once projected. The detachment in his eyes was profoundly unsettling. He must have read the concern on Sam's face, for he turned to him and struggled to muster a trace of conviction.
What are you two doing here, Sam?
We need to talk, Sam told him.
And then?
And then we figure out how to stop this.
24. Saturday, April 22nd. The waitress, long and crooked like a bent cigarette, refilled their cups one by one with coffee as black as river mud. They offered polite smiles, waiting until she had moved down the line of booths before anyone broke the silence.
What's the situation, then? Daniel asked them.
He had ordered a mound of burned bacon, scrambled eggs, and hash browns smothered in ketchup, just to show them that he was fine, that he was eating, that there was nothing to worry about. But he took one bite of the bacon and set it back down.
Look at us, Sam thought. We're not sleeping. We're not eating. I weigh less than I did in high school. And more. She's lost her definition. She looks exhausted. But Daniel, he's wasting away. He's being devoured from the inside.
Sam watched him push the hash browns around on the plate with a fork.
People must think he's sick, that he has a terrible disease.
In a way, he did. They all did.
Well?
Daniel was growing impatient. Moore turned to Sam, one eyebrow raised. Do you want to tell him or should I?
I'll do it, Sam volunteered. He took a breath. Begin at the beginning.
And so Sam told Daniel about the events that had transpired since their trip to Kill Creek. He told of the insatiable need to write that had pushed him to the breaking point of sanity, of the inspiration that had become oppression, of the sense that he was back at the Finch house every time he stepped away from the computer, of the visit from Eli, from which he learned the details of Moore's latest opus, and finally of visiting Moore in Los Angeles and discovering that their books were impossibly similar. As Sam recounted his tale, Daniel sank deeper and deeper into his seat. It was the first time he hated, truly hated, being captivated by a story. Daniel looked to Moore, a thought occurring to him.
You haven't insulted me once since you guys got here.
Sorry, she said.
That worries me, Daniel explained. Anything that can take the piss out of you worries me.
He shoved away the plate of food.
I take it you've been working on a new book, too? Sam said.
Yeah.
Is it similar to your other books?
Not even close.
Describe it to us.
Daniel did. The plot was no surprise to Sam. The specifics were different. Character names, location, motives. But the basic structure was exactly the same as his and Moore's, right down to the moment when the first brick fell from the wall.
How many pages have you written? Sam asked.
Touching his thumb to his fingers, Daniel did a quick mental count.
At least 2,000, maybe more.
Double or single-spaced?
Single.
Jesus fist fucking Christ, Moore exhaled from low in her throat. That's not a novel, that's a monster.
Snatching up a thin paper napkin, Daniel wiped away the dots of sweat that had sprouted on his brow.
This has to be a coincidence, right? I mean, it's impossible. The three of us writing similar books.
Except they're not similar, Moore said.
They're the same. Exactly the same. Beat for beat.
They all fell silent. Around them were the sounds of the diner. Silverware clinking on plates, coffee cups being refilled, the murmur of voices. It was late, the day already a distant memory. For everyone else in the diner, it was just another Chicago night.
But for us, there was something with me in my house, Sam told them.
What was it? Daniel asked.
They don't need to know. Not yet.
Sam shrugged.
I don't know. A presence.
I saw it, too, in my place, Moore admitted. Her voice was low, as if she were afraid someone outside of their table might hear.
When I would stop writing, it would call to me. It would say my name.
Sam offered her a sad smile.
Still think it's just a mass delusion?
Moore thought for a moment. Then shook her head. Daniel rubbed his forehead so hard he left red streaks across his skin.
We never should have gone to that house. None of this would be happening if we hadn't gone there.
Then something occurred to him, his eyes wide.
What about Sebastian?
We haven't spoken to him, said Sam.
Daniel's face brightened.
Well, we should. Maybe he's not experiencing it. Maybe he's all right.
So? What if he is? What does it prove? Moore asked.
Nothing, Daniel admitted.
but it would at least mean that whatever's happening to us stops with us. It would mean it's contained.
Contained.
The word did not sit well with Sam. It conjured up images of a virus run amok, of men in hazmat suits working feverishly over doomed patients as dark rivers of blood poured from every orifice. The word made him feel as though they were infected with something unknown and therefore incurable. Three more bodies to throw on the fire.
"We have to go to Sebastian," Daniel insisted.
"We have to check on him. See if he's okay." Moore ran chipped fingernails over her face and let out a slow, irritated groan.
"This is just fantastic. We spend one night in that house, and now we're on a goddamn supernatural scavenger hunt."
Daniel shook his head.
"But it's obviously not just going to go away. We have to do something about it."
"I know we have to do something. Just give me a goddamn moment to express my fucking feelings."
Moore shoved her coffee cup away with a clank, a bit of Java spilling over the lip and onto the saucer beneath. Daniel smiled a small, pleased smile.
"That's the T.C. Moore I remember."
And then, as quickly as it had appeared, the smile faded, his face regaining its previous slackness. It was a transformation that happened much too easily, as if this were the first smile Daniel had allowed himself in a long time. The three sat quietly, Moore tapping a fingernail on the rim of her coffee cup, Daniel poking at his breakfast with disgust.
"I'm sorry about your daughter," Sam said suddenly. "I don't think I ever told you that."
Daniel paused, not looking up from the red traces of ketchup that cut through the sea of grease on his plate.
"Yeah. Well, shit happens."
Sam had expected "the Lord works in mysterious ways" or "everything happens for a reason," but not "shit happens." This was the death of Daniel's only child, after all. His flesh and blood, not a blown tire, not a stain on a freshly laundered shirt. "Shit happens" just didn't cut it. The waitress came around, warming their cups with piping hot coffee. Sam peered out the window that bordered one side of their booth. The parking lot was out there somewhere, cars in a neat row, snug between white lines. A sign featuring the name of the diner, Bailey's, surely spun at the side of the road, a neon arrow directing hungry travelers to the cozy comfort of the greasy spoon. Traffic must be rolling quietly down the street, anonymous faces fighting sleep as they made their way to destinations unknown. It was all there.
It had to be.
But Sam could not make it out. He stared through that window, and all he saw was darkness. 25. Sunday, April 23rd. They planned to fly to Ithaca, where they would check on Sebastian. There was still the chance that whatever was happening to them had, for some reason, left him alone. But they all doubted this was the case. They expected to find the old man in a similar state. Unfortunately, Sebastian Cole was somewhat of a recluse. There was no listing of a home address online. There was no official Sebastian Cole website. All sites dedicated to the literary legend were managed by fans, who kindly supplied the information on their Contact Us pages that all correspondence was to go through Cole's agent. The agent turned out to be a crusty bastard in New York who was equally tight-lipped about Sebastian's home address.
"All correspondence must go through me," he told them.
Hail Mary calls to local bookstores in Ithaca also turned out to be dead ends.
"Mr. Cole keeps to himself," one shop owner said. "See him at Pat's Diner now and again, but can't tell you much about where he lives except that I've heard it's off Ridge Road. Or is it Towanoc? I know it's near the lake."
They were trying to plan their next move when Sam got a call on his cell phone.
"She's dead."
The voice was familiar. Sam tried to place it.
"Who's dead?" he asked, confused. "Who is this?"
"It's Justin."
The name meant nothing to him.
The caller must have sensed this, for he immediately followed it with,
Wainwright. It's Wainwright.
Justin Wainwright. It was strange to think of this odd young man as having a first name. It was almost 8 in the morning when he called. The three of them had stayed at the 24-hour diner until dawn, talking and drinking coffee. After the early morning call to Sebastian's agent, Sam and Moore had accompanied Daniel back to his home so that he could pack a bag. Thankfully, his wife was at church, allowing Daniel to go about his business without a messy confrontation. When Sam's cell phone rang, he stepped out the back door and onto a semicircular slab of concrete that served as the Slaughter family's patio. A 5-burner stainless steel grill was positioned on one side, a wicker couch and 2 outdoor chairs on the other.
"Who's dead?" Sam asked again.
"Careful. This is Wainwright. You don't know what he's up to."
Wainwright cleared his throat.
"Kate. You know, my...
I know who you're talking about, asshole. But... dead? Kate's dead?"
Sam could no longer feel his legs. He let his body slip down into one of the chairs, his eyes darting back and forth but focusing on nothing.
"How?"
he finally managed to choke out.
"Killed herself!"
Wainwright practically screamed it. He cleared his throat again, attempting to keep his emotions under control.
"She slit her wrist some." "No. Slit isn't right. She savaged herself. Cut her bloody arm to shreds. Last Thursday, her landlord found her on the floor of her apartment, lying there."
"Oh my God.
Why would she do that?"
"Why the hell's everyone asking me like I know what the hell's going on?" Sam wondered.
Eventually, Wainwright admitted to Sam that Kate had changed over the past few months. She had grown increasingly paranoid, claiming at first that someone was tampering with her footage. She began arriving late to shoots, then not showing up at all. At the same time, their personal relationship was suffering. She wouldn't return his calls. She stopped coming over to spend the night. At first, he thought she was blowing him off, that she had tired of him. But Kate had always been so kind and understanding. She had seen past his money and his pathetic quest to prove his worth to the world. She had truly liked him for who he was.
"There aren't a lot of people who like me, Sam," he admitted.
No kidding, Sam thought. Ultimately, Wainwright had no choice but to let Kate be, both personally and professionally. Then one night in late March, he spotted her crossing the street in Soho. Her appearance was shocking, her face slack, thick shadows under her eyes, clothes and hair unwashed. He called out to her, but she quickened her pace and disappeared down the crowded sidewalk. A week later, he stopped by her apartment and knocked. He was sure she was home. He had heard shuffling from inside, but she never answered the door. Now she was dead.
"Sam?"
Wainwright asked hesitantly.
"You there?"
"I'm here," Sam assured him. Wainwright lowered his voice, as if he were afraid someone might overhear.
"Look, I know you think I'm a piece of shite. That interview last year, it wasn't exactly above board. I get it. That's on me. But I swear, it was supposed to be good for all of us. It wasn't supposed to be. Whatever this is. Whatever started after we got back from Kansas."
Sam felt the world fall away from his feet, leaving him floating in empty space.
"What do you mean?"
A sharp breath from the other end of the line.
"What's happening to you?" Sam asked.
"Nothing.
Bullshit.
It's probably just my imagination, but..."
"But what, Wainwright? Damn it, tell me!"
Another pause. Then,
"I've seen things. Usually just out of sight, you know. Sometimes at night, moving in the shadows. At first I thought it was my eyes playing tricks on me until the other night. After I found out about Kate. I was alone in my apartment, and I had been crying, and I heard someone laugh. Right behind me. Like a chuckle, you know? Raspy. Like an old woman. It was right there behind me, and it was Damwell enjoying seeing me in pain. Sam's flesh prickled at the thought, icy fingers tracing his spine. I couldn't turn around. Wainwright continued. I tried, but I was terrified, Sam. Something told me that whatever was behind me, I didn't want to see it. There was another chuckle, and then it reached out and tapped me on the shoulder. Just one finger, tapping me, asking me to turn around. I closed my eyes and muttered something under my breath. Muttered what? A prayer, I guess. I don't know, I tried to wish it away. I knew that if I turned around, if I did see it, I would go crazy. I knew I would be looking at something that shouldn't exist. Something unnatural. I must have stood there for at least 10 minutes. Wainwright's words were slower, his voice steady. Finally, I couldn't stand it anymore. So I took a breath and spun around. And there was nothing there. Absolutely nothing. I was alone, like I had been all day. He gave an embarrassed laugh. God, it sounds so silly when I say it out loud. You must think I've lost it, mate.
He's not messing with you, Sam told himself. He's scared. Really scared.
Leaning back in the patio chair, Daniel's house seemed to loom over Sam, blank windows reflecting the sun and sky, taking on the appearance of multiple eyes, like those of a spider, motionless, waiting for the perfect moment to strike. He hadn't noticed it before, but the two-story structure had an attic window, perched slightly higher than the rest, a single pane that gave the house the illusion of a third story.
Sam? Wainwright called from almost 1,000 miles away. Sam, are you there?
Wainwright met them at LaGuardia Airport. He did his best to fake a smile.
It's good to see you, he said.
Sam knew that he meant it. That uncanny, rubbery look to Wainwright's flesh was still there, but his hair was greasy and flat. What had seemed like purple streaks in his eyes when they'd first met were now gone. It was 1 o'clock by the time they drove into the city. Harsh rays of sunlight cut through the towering black forms of skyscrapers. Even though only April, it was a scorcher of a day, the heat shimmering off the asphalt in spectral waves. New York City smelled like a foul, musky beast, the very sidewalk sweating in the blazing sun. They mostly rode in silence through the heavy traffic. Half an hour later, they pulled into a parking garage on the Upper East Side. Wainwright called it an apartment, but in reality it was the entire top floor of a 15-story building overlooking central Manhattan. Multiple walls had been taken down to create an expansive loft with floor-to-ceiling windows. In the distance, sunlight glinted off the surface of the reservoir in Central Park. It was exactly the kind of bachelor pad one might expect from Wainwright. Hardwood floors stained black, stainless steel appliances, monochromatic furniture. The few punches of color were from pieces of framed artwork by unknown artists and vintage grindhouse movie posters. Dividing the loft were bookshelves packed with vinyl records, tattered paperbacks, and countless Blu-ray discs of obscure genre movies. Wainwright did not say a word as he hurried across his loft to the kitchen. Rising up on his toes, he fished a bottle of whiskey from a high cabinet above the refrigerator. Ice clinked as he dropped a handful of cubes into a tumbler. He unscrewed the cap and clumsily sloshed 3 fingers of hooch into the glass. He took a long, desperate sip. Sam glanced around at the impeccably clean space, so different from all of their homes. Free of filthy plates, empty bottles, and stacks of printer paper, the detritus Sam had found almost comforting during the past months. Seeming to sense Sam's thoughts, Wainwright motioned to the room with his tumbler of scotch.
Cleaning lady. Comes twice a week.
He gulped down the rest of his drink, sucking the alcohol from the ice cubes. He held up the glass.
Anybody?
He asked. Moore raised her slender